This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, and thank you for joining us on our Main Street all across North Dakota this time of day. Today, I'm joined in studio by Ashley Thornburg in Fargo and in studio by Jacqueline Van Meter in Bismarck. Jacqueline is the StoryCorps site manager. She has wrapped up StoryCorps' mobile tour in Bismarck. It ended on Friday, and she joins us to talk about the experience. Thanks for being with us, Jacqueline.
Thanks for having me back, guys. Good to be here.
Well, how did it go in Bismarck?
Oh, it was such a lovely, lovely time. You know, we were able to spend a little over 4 weeks recording and got to just meet a lot of incredibly kind and welcoming folks here. We couldn't have had a better time.
Well, how did it go? How many people did you have come through the mobile Airstream recording studio?
So many people coming in and out. And over the last 4 weeks, we ended up recording a total of 96 conversations with 196 participants in just 4 weeks. So it was a pretty solid showing from the folks in Bismarck.
That's a lot of recorded material.
Oh, yes. And you can imagine each one of those interviews, you know, the whole process is about an hour. So lots of quality time with folks here.
What are some of the themes that started to develop? Were there recurrent themes?
Yeah, you know, there's always such an eclectic mix of things that people want to talk about because they have different intentions coming into the booth. But one thing that really struck me was, one, of course, being able to hear from some of the folks representing Native communities here and the experiences that they have living here, and everything from things like preserving the Lakota language and traditions to, you know, the experiences with the Dakota Access Pipeline protests and so forth. And then another thing that really stood out to me was there was just a tremendous amount of pride from folks in their sort of homesteading heritage, you know, stories of great grandparents coming here, you know, in sort of the late 19th century and the challenges that they faced, you know, bearing the elements with few resources, and how that sort of imparted values into their families that have really withstood the test of time and been passed down to generation from generation to generation. So.
Did you have to change out the Kleenex box ever?
Oh, yeah. We always do that a couple of times, Doug. Absolutely.
So there might be some jewels from this 96 hours or so that you gathered in Bismarck, that some of this might find its way on NPR programming like Morning Edition, something like that?
Sure. Well, I mean, you know, we think of each conversation as a real jewel. And, you know, so many things stand out for different reasons. And we know that a lot of folks walked away discovering new things that they didn't hear before about people in their lives, or just taking the time to say things they'd never really properly said. But certainly we've gotten some stories that I'm sure will be very compelling for listeners that the Prairie Public folks, of course, have already started broadcasting. I think you guys have something like 8 or 9 posts already up. So we'll see whether or not they make it to national, but they've certainly been a joy for us to listen to.
Well, Ashley Thornburg and Eric Detheridge have been going through a lot of this material that we have used occasionally on Main Street already.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. No, it has been really a fun experience because, boy, you think you live somewhere most of your life and you've kind of heard it all, especially with a small population state like North Dakota, and especially growing up and not recognizing the diversity that is here. So, you know, if I may, Jacqueline, just sort of step in on your interview.
Come on in.
and just talk about going through that process. Really rewarding. Sometimes they were really frustrating to hear. I would hear about experiences of, you know, what a man's mother went through because she happened to be unmarried at the time of conception. And this was back in the 50s. And it sounded like a really terrible process that many of the women went through at that time. And then I would hear these fantastic stories of a grandson who was just pleased at how active his grandmother was in state politics. And you get these multi-generational stories. And yeah, I mean, I think our Kleenex budget kind of went through that. We might need a special fundraiser for just for that. And then I really enjoyed, Jacqueline, the outreach event where we actually got to talk at the Heritage Center, play clips for people, and then have the room of people who had done a StoryCorps interview asking questions to other people who had done a StoryCorps interview. So I want to hear more about, like, the outreach events and why those are so important.
Oh, sure. Yeah, and I totally agree. Honestly, Ashley, that the listening event that we hosted last week at the Heritage Center, you know, in which you were able to present so many of those great clips that you and Eric worked on, and we were able to share those with the community at large and so many participants who came to the room. It was honestly one of the best ones I've ever been to. Mm-hmm. We just had an incredible time. I was just really, really pleased to see how engaged and excited, you know, everybody in the audience was to sort of ask each other questions and to tell each other, in particular, what it meant to hear those stories on air and how moving they were. That was really, really cool.
Jacqueline, one of the things that I'm kind of curious about is sort of the alchemy that occurs here, because actually what you're doing is you're asking people to come into a place they haven't been in before, sit in front of a microphone, and share something that is profoundly intimate in many cases, something they hadn't done in the privacy of their own home with their own relatives, you know, previous to this. So what is it about that environment that encourages that kind of interaction?
Well, I love that you asked that, Doug, because we actually posed that very question to our audience members just last week to see what they had to say. And, you know, I think there is an absolute magic that happens when you're just sitting across from someone that you know and you love, and there are no distractions, no interruptions. And in some way, that microphone gives you permission to sort of ask the bigger questions. And the knowledge that these stories are going to be recorded and archived at the Library of Congress sort of just sets a tone that this is the time to sort of say the important things. And what ends up coming out of that sort of formula is something that I think is so moving for the participants and certainly for folks who are able to listen to that later.
So have you been in the booth with anyone? I know working for StoryCorps, oftentimes you end up doing an interview with someone who comes in by themselves. But I'm asking, have you gone in with a grandmother or, you know, a boyfriend or what have you?
Yeah, I definitely have. I think my all-time favorite, I've done one booth interview, which is that I've gone into, not the mobile booth, but we have a little recording booth, like a brick-and-mortar thing in New York. And my dad came to visit right before I moved away from New York, actually, to take this job. It was just a few weeks before I came out on the road. And so he and I sat down together, and I was able to interview him a little bit. And it was just, yeah, he choked up. I choke up thinking about it. It was a really beautiful time.
Well, in this day of family trees that are virtual, that are online, that everybody can kind of contribute to, photos and this and that, I'm thinking a number of these StoryCorps interviews must be appended to family trees these days, because you also give the people who participate a recording.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. I mean, that's, you know, regardless of whether folks do or don't decide that they want to archive in the Library of Congress, every participant receives a copy to do with what they wish. And so, we've certainly seen some interesting uses. You know, people will play these at family events or edited clips, you know, at gatherings or, you know, family reunions and things like that. There's just a lot of cool stuff you can do with these stories.
Well, and I'm sort of assuming that, you know, next generation's Ken Burns is going to be using a lot of these things, or next generation's Studs Terkel is going to be going back and getting that, recreating that slice of life portrait of life.
Yeah,
right now.
Exactly. I mean, I think, you know, people love the broadcast. It's how people discover us and get to know us. And, you know, we really handpick these really poignant moments. But what will really be the legacy of StoryCorps and what excites me to think about what I'm contributing to building is the archive and all of just the amazing myriad of perspectives that we've been able to collect over the last, you know, 15 years.
And imagine if we'd had this capability 100 or 200 years ago,
the
rich material that we would have, that I probably couldn't keep my ears off it, to be honest with you, hearing people talk about real events and their real voices from, you know, historical past.
Absolutely. You know, we actually went out, you know, to your question earlier, Ashley, about outreach. We went to the Burleigh County Senior Center a couple of weeks ago. And, you know, I think one thing that I observed about folks in Bismarck is not everybody is so inclined to just grab the microphone and tell their story. You know, there's a modesty and a humility in the culture here that's runs deep. But one of the things that I mentioned to them when they, you know, when folks at the Senior Center said, I don't know about all this, I'd say, well, do you like history? Well, yeah. And are you proud of your, you know, homesteading great-grandparents and grandparents? Yeah, yeah. Imagine if you could hear them having a conversation between husband and wife about what it was like doing that. And then things really started to percolate for folks. So I totally agree. agree with you, Doug. It's amazing to think that we're creating something that generations from now people will be able to go back and listen to in that way.
And you have mentioned there are physical sites that people can go into. And then, of course, there's the mobile tour that goes to 10 cities a year. And, you know, it seems a little bit sad to be doing this wrap-up one and saying, sorry, Bismarck, if you missed your chance, you're out of luck. There are other ways to contribute still.
Yeah, absolutely. So we have a mobile application that is free to download on your phone. And, you know, if you experienced recording a StoryCorps interview, you know that there's a facilitator in the room that kind of walks you through the process. But if you don't have one of those experiences in a booth, the app will basically do the same thing. It helps you to prepare questions. You can move from question to question. It shows a little timer so that you know where you are in the 40 minutes. At the end, just like in the booth, it prompts you to snap a photo of you and your interview partner, and you are able to upload it directly to a collection at the Library of Congress that's physically downloaded in Washington, D.C., where it's preserved just like any other signature StoryCorps interview.
Wow. So you don't have to wait for the mobile tour to come by. You can actually invite it into your home anytime.
You absolutely can. And if you're listening from Bismarck and you didn't have an opportunity to come and record, I would absolutely encourage you to check out our app. You can go to StoryCorps.org and find more information on how to download it. And you can use the hashtag Bismarck Stories as a keyword to be collected with other stories that we've collected here in Bismarck.
Jacqueline, how long have you been on the road with StoryCorps?
So, interesting question. On the mobile tour, I joined in April of 2018. So it's been a few months for me now, and I'm going to continue on until April 2019. But I actually joined full-time at StoryCorps in April of 2017. And I was on a team that's based in Brooklyn, but that does a lot of recordings of different special partnerships. Sometimes we get grants for different initiatives to record, for example, the stories of folks who have been impacted by incarceration or stories of the LGBTQ community. And on that team, I also traveled quite a bit. Although I was based in Brooklyn, I'd be on an airplane three or four times a month. So I've really seen so much of the country in a lot of different capacities in my 2 years at StoryCorps.
And next, you're off to Kansas City?
That's right. Kansas City. We're leaving on Sunday, and we're opening our doors in Kansas City, Missouri on Thursday.
What kind of downtime do you have? I mean, I know you're in a city 4 and 5 weeks, but you do get vacation time.
Downtime. You know, I've heard of it.
Yeah, right? What is a weekend?
Indeed. Certainly it's a high priority of everybody on the mobile tour to try to do what they can in their downtime to get to know the city a little better. And, you know, you're in with the community, you know, several days a week listening to the stories of people, and those stories are often shaped by the places where they live. So we were all certainly super motivated to get out and about and see what we could see in North Dakota while we were here. I, of course, was able to enjoy the 4th of July at the Capitol right here at the Heritage Center and see the fireworks. You know, but we jumped in the Missouri River. We've gone out to Medora and seen the Theodore Roosevelt National Park. We enjoyed a night at the Sleepy Hollow Outdoor Theater and saw the performance of Hunchback of Notre Dame a couple of days ago. So we've really tried to dig into Bismarck as much as possible.
Well, from the perspective of somebody who doesn't live here, what will you most remember about this experience?
Oh, gosh. You know, people are just so warm and so kind. The kindness of folks here has just really struck me. And like I said, there's sort of a modesty and a humility, and everybody who participated seemed to really want to just speak to kind of the good work of the community and the pride of being a part of the sort of larger Bismarck and North Dakota family. And that really stood out to me. So I think that's what I'll think of when I think back on my time here.
Well, now you're heading off to Kansas City, as you mentioned. So you move every month.
That's true.
That has to get a little old.
You know, I've been a little bit of a floating leaf for many years, so it sort of fits in with my lifestyle. But, you know, it's a challenge, too, when you want to balance getting to those places and seeing all that you can see of a city or a region, and also making sure you factor in some downtime. You know, it can feel like one big long road trip, but it's not vacation. You know, this is my life and this is my work, so I got to take a little time off every now and again, too, and just stay in.
What kind of outreach partners will you have in an area like Kansas City? You know, here you reached out with the Lakota Language Institute in Kansas City. Wouldn't wouldn't necessarily be the Lakota language. What outreach partners do you have there?
Sure. Yeah. And I would like to just shout out some of our really incredible outreach partners in Bismarck, because we can't get the representation and the breadth of stories without the work of community partners helping us to really reach a broad cross-section of the community here. So, you know, certainly the Lakota Language Consortium was wonderful. We got some great recordings from them, Bismarck Global Neighbors, African Immigrant Services, of course, the Burley County Senior Center, Bismarck State College, which not only sent a bunch of wonderful folks our way, but also gave us accommodations. We stayed there for the last few weeks. And we actually just did some recording at the North Dakota Boys and Girls Ranch on site. So that was amazing. And, you know, in Kansas City, in some ways, it's similar. We're going to be working with a lot of kind of neighborhood-based community organizations, just focused on sort of, you know, economic empowerment of different neighborhoods. We're going to be partnering with a literacy organization that focuses on family literacy, so adult literacy, as well as, you know, their children. I think we've got a number of, you know, just kind of heavy hitters who are really active in the Latinx population, not necessarily specific organizations, but individuals that are just really well connected. So Kansas City should be interesting. We've gotten a lot of great engagement from partners so far.
Well, I can certainly tell you that Prairie Public has enjoyed partnering with you, because this has been very valuable for us and for our listeners. So thank you, Jacqueline Van Meter.
Oh, it wouldn't have been what it was without Prairie Public. We wouldn't be here. So thanks to you guys, and thanks to the entire team here in Bismarck and in Fargo for everything y'all have done to make this happen. It's been unforgettable.
Jacqueline Van Meter is the StoryCorps site manager. Coming up next, we'll hear an excerpt from StoryCorps with Tasha and Kevin Carvel.
Arts programming on Prairie Public is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, a state agency developing, promoting, and supporting the arts in North Dakota.
Today's programming is made possible in part by John and Rebecca Petrick, in celebration of their 40 years of wedded bliss. And by the Bush Foundation, investing in great ideas and the people who power them in Minnesota, North Dakota, and South Dakota. Learn more at bushfoundation.org.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. In today's world, a father raising a daughter on his own might not raise any eyebrows. 40-some years ago, it was more unusual. Tasha Carvel met her dad, Kevin, at the StoryCorps mobile recording studio in Bismarck to tell him he inspired her love for travel and an affinity for the underdog.
My name is Tasha Carvel. I am 43 years old here in Bismarck, North Dakota, and I'm here with my dad.
I'm Kevin Carvel, age 72.
Hey, Dad. We were talking a little bit about this last night, but I was thinking about you raising me and me being... How old was I when you and Mom got divorced?
You know, the marriage was slowly collapsing over a period of time, and your mother had moved away, so I've actually never been quite certain, but about five years old.
Yeah. Were you scared to raise me by yourself ever?
No, I wasn't. Not at all. No, it didn't feel like a frightening, you know, it was a little bit maybe exasperating, like, shoot, I've got to do this all myself now, but it wasn't frightening.
Yeah. Did you feel like you had good support from our family?
Oh, yeah. Everybody was wonderful. You know, even your mother's family and others were, everybody was very supportive and helpful.
Mm-hmm. Was it ever awkward?
Well, yeah. You know, I mean, you were a little girl, so, you know, we had to go through bathing and, you know, it wasn't awkward.
The first time I had to go bra shopping and you took me to, I think, Dayton's, and you brought me to the, like, little girl section and you just... steered me by the shoulders to the sales lady and said, "She needs bras. I'll be over here whenever we're ready to pay."
Yeah, there was some awkward, but not very much. It went pretty smoothly.
I feel like now would be an easier time for a dad to raise a daughter by himself, but I just was wondering if that time it was a little stranger or something.
Well, it was a little strange because there were very few fathers doing it all by themselves, but it didn't feel strange at all. It didn't feel difficult. It didn't feel awkward, and felt like an honor to be doing it. Mm-hmm. You know, you felt like you were doing, you know, the Lord's work here. And, mm-hmm. You know, you're sort of proud of yourself.
Because I was that difficult. It was the Lord's work.
No, you know, but it was tricky going to some things. They say, well, well, you know, at a PTA meeting, say, well, we'll have all the moms and Kevin then come over here to do this. So,
How do you think you got so nice? You're so nice to people. you're like a collector of lost souls.
Yeah, I know. I had the garbage man came to mind. He comes wandering over to my house. He's been there the last couple of days, wants to come and visit. So he comes in and he reeks of the garbage dump. And
another stray cat.
Yeah. And I don't know. When I was little, I felt, when I was small, I was small. I mean, I'm still not big, but I was really little. I was the littlest guy in the class.
You're a runt.
Yeah. And so you felt maybe something for the underdog. And even though you were excelled academically, I was also almost a year younger than my classmates. So I felt that kind of immaturity around them too. So that probably resulted in me being sort of quiet.
You have empathy.
Yeah, but being small and younger than everybody. And, you know, and so I don't know, I've always sort of taken to lost souls. And I remember there have been any number, beginning back in grade school, that you'd sort of befriend and they would be wonderfully grateful for it. And, also made you feel good and made them feel good and contributed to a better community and society. Yeah. And
you instilled that in me for sure. I always end up rooting for the underdog. It's painful though sometimes because those folks often have a poor lot in life.
Yeah.
It's just hard to sort of be on their side.
Yeah. Well, so you're meanwhile halfway through your life. So what are your plans for the next 40 years? How would you hope that this plays out for you?
I think I want to raise Ike in a happy home. Mm-hmm. And have him have interesting experiences. I want to travel with him and Nick. I want to have adventures.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We had great adventures when I was growing up.
Yeah.
I loved our road trips. They weren't international adventures or anything like that. I would love to have some international adventures with Ike, but just those road trips that we would go on to like South Dakota or Montana and, you know, you'd make me stop at every historical marker and drove me kind of crazy. Yeah. But those were really, those are memorable for me. And I think that they will be for Ike, and I want to make sure he has that kind of a life where it's not just, you know, just hanging out at home on the weekends all the time. I want to make sure he has adventures and happy ones.
Yeah, that's 20 years. And then?
And then, I don't know. I don't have a library to build or anything like you did.
How do you see yourself as
a old
70-year-old lady? What do you think will be going on?
I've never really projected that much forward. I mean, I think it's lovely when people like retire to the lakes.
Sit
on their decks and stare out over.
Well, I mean, life hands you. I mean, I expected to spend my last days in Fargo.
Yeah.
And here I am in Mott. You know, sort of a surprising turn of events, but it's been a satisfying one. So,
do you think your last days will be in Mott?
Well, yeah. I mean, I don't plan to move anywhere else. No. I mean, I've got the house that fits, and
I mean, you got 20 years yet.
But, you know, I mean, that town will continue in its decline and maybe its grocery store will disappear and maybe
it's, then what?
Well, you know, there are a number of those towns out there in the Leipzig and Regent would be examples, have community, you know, cooperative groceries run by community volunteers. But
no, but for you.
Well, I suppose at some point you'd get somebody, you'd send them into Bismarck every week with a grocery list and, you know, it'd be cost you. And
you know, we're about to move back to Fargo and a lot of your friends have commented that they want us to bring you with us, all of your old Fargo friends.
It'll be mine. I mean, obviously one may fall into dementia or some sort of terrible illness that requires nursing home care. You know, that'd be an unhappy time. But
even if you have dementia, Dad, I like visiting you. Well, thank you for visiting with me today.
All right. Well, this was entertaining.
Same.
The interview with Tasha and Kevin Carvel was recorded at the StoryCorps mobile booth at the Heritage Center in Bismarck, which ended its month-long residency last Friday and moved on to Kansas City. StoryCorps is a national initiative to record and collect stories of everyday people. Excerpts were selected and produced by Prairie Public. Our thanks to Basin Electric Power Cooperative of Bismarck for helping sponsor the StoryCorps visit to North Dakota. Coming up on Main Street, we'll talk with Lauren Springer, the marketing director for the Bismarck Larks baseball team, and horticulturist Ron Smith will answer some lawn and garden questions from our listener mailbag. First, though, the news with Danielle.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. Minot Republican State Senator David Hoag says he still plans to introduce a bill to use the Legacy Fund principal as a loan fund for some of the larger infrastructure projects around the state. Hoag is talking about low-interest loans for such things as Minot and Fargo flood control projects and the Red River Valley water supply project.
One advantage is we engage our legacy fund. We give it a purpose because it doesn't have a purpose, and it's quickly approaching $6 billion.
Hoag says it will allow the state to accelerate construction on those bigger projects and avoid the inflationary costs that go with the long-term projects.
Let's leverage this resource to produce long-term cost savings. And let's invest it in our communities rather than the $1.8 billion that's currently invested in municipal bonds around the country.
Hoag says he has been getting some support for this proposal. He says the biggest pushback comes from those who say they don't want to touch the principal.
All of the principal is at risk. It's invested in across the United States. It's in bonds. It's in equities. It's in international equity. It's already at risk. So you can't say that we're not touching the principal today. Every dollar of the $5.5 billion is touched. The question is, are you willing to invest a portion of that back into North Dakota infrastructure?
Touching the fund's principal would take a two-thirds vote of both houses. The 2018 Minnesota legislature passed a bill saying pornography is a contributing factor in human trafficking.
Pornography is really sex trafficking with the camera turned on.
Jason Adkins is the executive director of the Minnesota Catholic Conference. He lobbied the legislature in favor of the bill. Adkins says while the law doesn't ban or censor pornography, it allows law enforcement to collect data on the involvement of porn in human trafficking. The law also takes fines collected from child pornography offenses and directs them towards the state's Safe Harbor program. That program treats Minnesota youth who engage in prostitution or who are involved in sex trafficking as victims, not criminals.
Not every person who abuses pornography is involved in sex trafficking, but oftentimes it's the case that sex trafficking and pornography are inextricably linked. People need to know that when they're abusing pornography, they're help contributing to a $13 billion industry every year that has a prominent role in fueling the demand for sex trafficking.
Adkins was in Bismarck for an educational session on human trafficking held at the University of Mary. And as of today, all federally owned public housing in North Dakota will be smoke-free. Reba Mathern-Jacobson is Director of Tobacco Control for the state of North Dakota.
In North Dakota, this rule will provide protections for almost 3,000 residents who are in local public housing agencies in our state.
Mathern-Jacobson says the rule covers all interior units of a building as well as a 20-foot perimeter around a building.
So people in the past could have smoked in their own apartment, but they're no longer able to do that. And the reason this rule was enacted was to protect people from the risks associated with secondhand smoke exposure.
The rule was developed in late 2016. Mathern-Jacobson says by giving it a long rollout, it gave housing officials a chance to inform residents as well as get support in place for those looking to kick their smoking habit. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, joined now by Lauren Springer. She's at our Bismarck studio, and Lauren is with the Bismarck Larks, where she is the Director of Content Marketing and Media Relations. Thanks for joining us, Lauren.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, how's your team doing?
You know what? It has been a fast and furious season. It's been a wild ride, and it's hard to believe that we're actually winding down. We won the first half of the season. We ended up number one for the North Division, which means we're headed to the playoffs for the first time in team history. We're only 2 years old, but it's a really big deal for us.
Well, we recently spoke with General Manager John Bollinger, who I guess hired you away from Michigan, where you were in the news business, weren't you?
That's right. John and I go way back. We've known each other for about 6 years now. It's really fun to see where life takes you.
Well, life took you from a newsroom and a TV newsroom at that to promoting a baseball team.
You know what? I have no complaints. I really have the best job in the whole world. And I know lots of people say that or are paid to say that. But I get to just do wild and crazy things. I get to hang out outside all summer. And really, our mission is all about fun. You know, we say we're all about where fun makes a difference. And I get to eat, sleep, and breathe that every single day. So it's pretty awesome.
Well, one of the reasons we're talking with you today is because some of that fun involves us tonight. The
Oh, yeah.
Waterloo Bucks meet at the Bismarck Larks at 7:05 tonight at Dakota Community Bank and Trust Film Field in Bismarck. And the celebrity guest is Daniel Tiger.
We are so excited to have Daniel Tiger in the house. I can't wait to meet him in person. I have a 3-year-old nephew who is very jealous that I will have this celebrity interaction tonight. So,
well, you'll be meeting our Christine McClellan. She's the Prairie Public Outreach Director. She brings Daniel to you.
Awesome. We love deliveries.
Very good. Well, let's talk a bit about how this Bismarck Lark's team managed to attract all of this talent, though, from Michigan.
Oh, my goodness. Well, you know, it's kind of, like I said, it's kind of a wild ride. It's fun to see where life brings you. So John, I actually met John in Kalamazoo, Michigan. Yes, it's a real place. I was working in news, and he said, hey, we're bringing a baseball team to town, kind of like what happened here in Bismarck last year. So they said, you know, we're a little bit different. We do things. We have a baseball game, but we shoot people out of cannons, and we invite you to bring your dog to the ballpark, and we make these crazy concession items. And so we do all these wild and crazy things, plus there's a baseball game on top of it. So I met John doing some news stories and then kind of got to see an idea become a reality. And then these guys, he and his partner, Brian Colopy, who is still in Michigan and runs a couple of teams in Michigan, they just said this fun for just this one community isn't enough. So they've been expanding. He and his wife ended up here in Bismarck, and they said, hey, Lauren, come to Bismarck. And I said, I'm sorry, what? Come where? And I came out for a visit early this year, and, you know, it is North Dakota. You know, they say North Dakota nice, and it really is so true. Just the inviting, the community has been so welcoming, so warm, and so wonderful. And to see them embrace the team, and then also me as a person, has been really unbelievable. I couldn't ask for anything more.
Well, there's more to a baseball team than just the team. You just kind of mentioned that.
Yep.
There's that front office. You're part of that. You got some new married people working for you, too?
We sure do. We have August Taylor, who's with us. He was just named the student body president, and he did some media stuff for the team last year, and this year he's working in ticket sales, and he's kind of helping make sure that everyone's comfortable when they show up at the ballpark. So he's been absolutely fantastic. We're one little happy family. We spend a lot of time together, but our crew is awesome.
And for anybody who's been to any of these baseball games these days, professional, sometimes even the non-professional ones, there's more to it than just the game. There's that stuff that happens between the innings. So let's talk about that. That's Daniel Tiger, isn't it?
Daniel Tiger. He's going to be hanging out. Hopefully he'll be hanging out with little ones. And like I said, I've got to meet him, and I'm not a little one. So hopefully he'll be entertaining people of all ages, yes, in between innings. And then I think he's also going to be kind of hanging out and cheering our larks on during the game as well. So hopefully you'll get to, if you're a fan, you'll get to spend quite a bit of time with him. And I can tell you, yes, we have baseball, but as you mentioned, we do just about everything. So there is a little something for everyone at our games, or at least that's our goal. So if we're not meeting your needs, we definitely want to know.
Well, how do you program all that stuff that happens between innings?
You know, it is the most complicated puzzle I have ever seen in my life. So everything is timed. We have limited time between innings. We have about 90 seconds. So we try to think of what can we do that's a little bit different, that's super fun, that's going to be engaging for us, for the team, for the fans. So we actually sit down in a little room for half a day before the season starts and just start bouncing ideas off of each other to see kind of what sticks. And then once the season starts, we try them out and we kind of adjust accordingly. But we have the best fans. Our fans are really up for anything. We say, hey, we want you to make yourself into a human burrito on the field. Will you do that? And everybody says, oh, you have to wear this crazy taco hat, and people do it. You know, it's just so fun to see the community laugh and smile and really root each other on. We love that.
Well, what are some of the more bizarre things you have come up with?
The taco one, I enjoy the taco. we do something, this was our general manager's idea, water wars. So we take the card game war to a whole new level. So we have giant playing cards and we put two people up against each other. Hopefully they know each other. We've done like husband and wife, brother and sister, best friends, you know. So you play a game of war on the field, and if you lose, the winner gets to throw a giant cup of water in your face. So, you know, we just want to be silly. We want to have fun. We encourage people to laugh with each other, to laugh at each other. I mean, it's all about joy.
Well, when you go online and you read about Lauren Springer at the Bismarck Larks and you read through the whole blurb about her, the last sentence is, Lauren is a trained fire eater.
This is a true statement. This is a true statement. I will tell you, it's been a little while, but it was my final exam to graduate college. And the reasoning for this was it's something to put on your resume. And I will tell you, it's on my resume, and no one has ever not asked me about it. So I guess it's been pretty effective. It's an instant conversation starter.
It's not something you, keep burning over?
I will tell you, I've lost my eyelashes and eyebrows a time or two. But yeah, don't tell John. He's going to try to get me on the field probably to do that. So we'll just keep it a secret.
And you also are a big supporter of the Special Olympics.
Absolutely. Special Olympics is truly my my passion. And it's, I say, my happy place. I have a lot of joy in my life right now at work, which is awesome. But these athletes with intellectual disabilities are inspiring change all over the world, and their mission is inclusion. And I will tell you, if you have not had the opportunity to spend some time with a Special Olympic athlete, do it, because there is no way you will leave feeling anything but awesome.
Well, your blurb also mentions that you're a lifelong Detroit Tigers and Red Wings fan. That might be a little dangerous where you are right now.
I know. And I like to talk a big game, too. It's gotten me into a bit of trouble.
So, Lauren, when the season's over, are you still in Bismarck?
I absolutely am. You know, that's the question that people ask me all the time. But we are a 365-day fun business. So my job during the off season, I get to generate ideas on how to entertain fans when baseball isn't happening. So when I first started, the Winter Olympics were going on. So we did a whole series about we did Office Olympics in our office and put that out for fans. We let fans vote on who our winners were. But, you know, we're all year round. We don't want the Bismarck Larks to be just summer baseball and then for you to forget about us when the fall hits. We want you with us every single step of the way. We're entertainment. So how can we entertain you when there's 3 feet of snow outside and it's negative 22 degrees and you don't want to go anywhere?
All right.
Yeah.
Lauren Springer is with the Bismarck Larks. She's the Director of Content Marketing and Media Relations. There's a game tonight, the Waterloo Bucks game, 7:05 at Dakota Community Bank and Trust Field against the Bismarck Larks. Celebrity guest, Daniel Tiger. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks so much.
Coming up next, horticulturist Ron Smith.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by the Radisson Hotel of Bismarck, a full-service hotel located in downtown Bismarck. Preparing fresh Midwestern cuisine at the Terrace Restaurant or crafted cocktails and cold beer at the Off-Broadway Lounge. More information on booking your next hotel room online at radisson.com/Bismarck.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton with Ashley Thornburg and horticulturist Ron Smith.
Ron, thanks for coming in today.
You're welcome. Glad to be here.
End of July. What do we need to be talking about topically?
Saying goodbye to July.
Oh,
and looking forward to August because
that's when school starts.
And we look forward to the fall football season and the harvest season and all the wonderful things that come into the autumn of the year. But we also look forward to maybe giving up our weekly to maybe twice a week mowing of our lawns. And I've noticed in some cases that I've seen where people have never, ever sharpened their lawnmower blades. And so the result is kind of a dull-looking lawn. The grass is perfectly healthy, but it doesn't have that vigorous look to it. So my recommendation is to go ahead and have them sharpened. And I think I've told the story, haven't I, of the guy that went and had his blade sharpened. He took the blade off, took it over to Shields. They sharpened it nicely for him. He came, bought the blade back, put it on, and it was still looking pretty bad. He found out that he'd put the blade on backwards. And I'm not making this up, and it's not a stupid individual that did that. So make sure you have a sharp blade, sharpen it, If you've never sharpened it before, and put it back on correctly, and your lawn will look a lot better. And continue to mow high. Mow at 3 inches. Don't get low.
How often, let's just say you're mowing twice a week for the summer, do you need your blades sharpened every year, every three,
five? I'm preaching and I'm practicing, okay? I get the blades sharpened every year. Okay. I don't do it myself because it's just easier to take the mower in to have it serviced overall so it starts every time that you want it to. They clean it up. They sharpen the blade, and if the blade is too far gone, they'll replace it for you. So that makes it a heck of a lot easier. Use less gas, have a better-looking lawn, and it's a lot easier to push.
All right. We have an email question from Donovan in Reagan, North Dakota, and he says, I have planted 4 bur oak seedlings perhaps about 5 years ago. 4 of them are still alive, but they have hardly grown at all. Mm. The biggest is maybe 18 inches tall, and the trunk or stem, whichever is the correct word there, is quite crooked. How do I promote faster growth, and can I splint them to straighten them out?
Well, faster growth, I would ask him to go ahead and check how deep he has planted them and see if they are too deep, because oftentimes that's an indication that they've been planted too deeply. Or they've been kept too wet, the soil is saturated, but the tree can go ahead and survive, or the seedling can go ahead and survive somehow, but it's not going to be vigorous. And it's just something that's one of the first things you go ahead and check. See where the crown of that stem is. If it's below the surface of the ground, pull that soil back so that the crown is right even with that. And that's where you transition from being a stem or a trunk into a root system. So that transition area known as the crown of the tree needs to be at ground level and not buried 2 or 3 inches below the surface of the ground. That's probably the biggest cause why they are not doing as well as they should be. They should be taking off and growing vigorously, 8 to 12 inches a year easily.
Wow.
So that's the big reason.
All right. Well, here's an email question, and this one actually came to us from Lake City, Colorado.
Oh, wow.
We have a cabin in a spot that is very sunny and generally dry during the summer months. In front, there is a long, tall, man-made mound. The soil in the mound is somewhat rocky but of reasonably good quality, and it drains well. We planted some blue and Colorado spruce trees 4 years ago for screening and installed a drip irrigation system. Since then, we've replaced several of the spruce because many turned yellow, then brown, and died. Several of the trees still have a yellow cast, so early this June we began ramping up the irrigation rate. We now irrigate every night for 10 hours, giving each tree a total of about 1 to 2 gallons per minute at 2 points of the drip line. They seem to be improving and are putting out new growth. Are we going to have to water them forever?
Well, basically what they're doing is they're growing hydroponic trees.
Lots of water, that's for sure.
Yeah, just pure water, and the soil is just being there to help stabilize them and keep them up and provide structure for the trees. That should not be happening. I mean, they're doing something wrong. I would suggest that they back off and water it less often but more deeper. In other words, let it maybe once a week. Give it a good soaking, let it dry down, check the soil to see how far down it is wet or damp. If it's down 4 to 6, 8 inches, that's plenty deep enough for it to be moist. The top can be dry, then once again, go ahead and water it. The roots are very smart, okay? They will follow the path of least resistance. So if they run into a barrier, they're going to try to go around that barrier like a stone or a caliche layer, clay layer that can't be penetrated. So they'll try to grow around that or grow over the surface of it, and so it's just one of those things. They will follow the percolating water system. So give them a chance to follow that water that's being drained. If you keep it right up there at the top part of the soil, the roots aren't going to be motivated to go ahead and follow that water. You're giving it all right to them. You're growing them hydroponically.
How do you make a drip line?
Oh, it's very simple. Take a hose and poke holes in it. That makes it drip. That's oversimplification. But you can buy them at hardware stores very easily, and it's very simply something that you can go ahead and set up yourself. You can hitch it up to your outdoor spigot. They have a water meter, a pressure reducer there that you can go ahead and install, so you're not going to be blowing your drippers out of the hose. and it'll nail it down or slow down the pressure and the flow so that you're not going to be getting a high pressure coming out of there. That's because typically our Fargo and most water systems will have a 50 to 60 pound pressure, and all you need is about 12 to 18 pounds of pressure for drip irrigation systems.
And these people were putting thousands of gallons of water.
I would hate to see their water bill. They could have an Olympic swimming pool with all the water they were using.
Okay. Wow. Another question here that came in via email. A person who has two young weeping pussy willow trees that planted in the spring, and one tree's tips have turned hard and brown. And what does this mean, and what can this person do?
And they've been watering it on a regular basis?
Does not indicate in the question.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know how to answer that.
I'm stumped. Generally, they grow almost like weeds. They're best left alone. There must be some kind of an environmental impact that's causing that an anomaly as far as the growth goes. I just don't know what to go ahead and nail it down to without having a sample in hand and maybe taking it to a plant diagnostic lab. So,
but it's not good news.
No, it's definitely not good news. So.
Okay. Well, we got another tree question here. This is a fruit tree. I have some plums that have worm damage. I believe pectin is coming out of the plums. Sprayed them with a fruit insecticide during blossoming, but they are starting to fall off the tree. Advice?
Well, this is there's a maggot out there that's laid by a moth. That's called plum curcurial damage, and that's spelled C-U-R-C-U-I-L-O. And that's best thing you can do is go ahead and pick those plums and get them out of there, get them removed, and then spray the tree early in the spring before the first bud break. As the buds are starting to swell, spray them with an insecticide. Like malathion, and that will help to control their return. If you don't do anything about it, it'll be continually infested with these maggots, the juvenile stage of the moth. Anyhow, you can also place pheromone traps. These are sexual traps that will attract that particular insect into the trap, thinking they're going to be finding a mate to go ahead and live happily ever after with. And they get trapped, and they aren't going to be able to lay their eggs into the developing fruit. So a couple of ways you can go ahead and control it. But
all right.
First of all, get that picked off. Anything you see that's like that, get the fruit picked off and get it disposed of. Don't let it fall to the ground.
Well, maggots should get our attention.
Oh, yeah. Especially if you bite into an apple or a plum and see the other half of the maggot.
Yeah, you never want to see half a maggot. We have an email question actually from England. This person has a Christmas cactus that was given as a gift 3 or 4 years ago. It blooms well. It has been repotted once. However, it has started to develop some tiny spots on the new growth leaves. They look like raised pinpricks that are yellow in the middle, and some of them have turned dark purple. Removing the problem stems would amount to about losing a third of the plant. So this person's hesitant to do that. Do you have some advice?
Well, this could be due to a scale that's feeding on the foliage, on the underside of the foliage. And most people will miss the scale insect because they are very clever and that they blend in quite nicely with the environment that they're on. And you notice them when it's too late. If you have your Christmas cactus sitting on the table and suddenly that table surface becomes sticky, and you think, you blame your spouse. What did you do, spill syrup there or sugar there or something sweet there? No, it's from the scale feeding above there. And you take a closer look at that Christmas cactus or whatever plant it might be, and looking close, looking at the underside of the leaves, looking at where the leaf petiole is attached to the stem, you'll probably find a little tiny lump there about the size of about a quarter the size of your small fingernail. And these are little feeders, and then they have what they call a crawling stage, which these little characters are about the size of a dot at the end of a sentence in a newspaper, okay? So they'll crawl around and insert their stylets and begin feeding. Then as they feed, they cause this exudate to come out of both their bodies and out of the feeding port, and that gets all sticky. Well, that deprives the plant of the nutrient that it needs to be vigorous and beautiful and healthy and everything else. And so they need to go ahead and take a look at that. So getting a hold of some kind of a an insecticide that would be appropriate over there in England, and I'm not going to try to tell her what one to go ahead and use, but finding the right insecticide to use over there to control those. England, the English are very good horticulturists as a generalization. They are. And so they should be able to find something that would be able to keep that under control.
All right. Well, if you have a question for our horticulturist,
email it to mainstreet@prairiepublic.org or find us on Facebook, Main Street at Prairie Public.
Dakota Date Book is next.
Financial fraud, tax evasion, election interference, collusion? As the trial of former Trump campaign chairman Paul Manafort begins, what impact will it have on the ongoing Mueller investigation?
You know, Paul Manafort worked for me for a very short period of time. He worked for many other Republicans.
What's at stake in the case against Manafort on the next Morning Edition?
That's tomorrow morning, right here on Prairie Public. This is Dakota Datebook for July 30th. The Homestead Act, beginning in 1862, drew many settlers to the opportunities of the West, opening up millions of acres to citizens who could prove up the land. With time, a variety of changes occurred, including the addition of a Desert Land Act, which was passed in 1877. This law was to encourage and promote development of land that would otherwise be considered less than ideal. Individuals applying for a desert land entry were expected to irrigate the claimed land to make it useful. Proving up a homestead and finally receiving the required patent for ownership could take a bit of time. But for Henry A. Kelly of Grinnell in Williams County, it took a little longer than normal. Kelly took out a desert claim near Grinnell in 1888, one of the first in the area. In 1892, he proved up on the land, but like many other old-timers, he hadn't paid close attention to all the details. For some unaccountable reason, the paperwork for receiving his patent lay in the Minot Land Office for 2 years and was not discovered until another man filed on the land. Kelly's desert claim became the first of its kind to be contested in the United States. It was argued that his land was not eligible to be under the Desert Land Act. Kelly's attorney, James Johnson of Minot, fought the matter for several weeks. Johnson said the government had built an irrigation system in the area in an attempt to grow oats at Buford. That attempt had been abandoned, but then Kelly filed for the land. He developed it by working with what the government had started, building up dams and making the land usable for agriculture. He was successful in setting up a good irrigation system and raising an excellent crop. In the end, Attorney Johnson won the day. After more than two decades since filing his claim, it was reported on this date in 1910 that Kelly would soon receive the needed patent to take ownership. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Sarah Walker. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from the North Dakota Humanities Council.
Tuesday on Main Street. Is it moodiness or depression? It can be hard to tell the difference between a normal teen and a troubled teen. Well, Ashley Thornburg will visit with Felicia Johnson Tuesday. She is a youth mentor and mental health advocate and the author of a trilogy of books inspired by her real-life experiences with bipolar disorder and Felicia Johnson's best friend's challenges with borderline personality disorder. So that interview is coming up on Tuesday, as well as Bill Thomas's visit with Capital City Gallery President David Borlaug. He'll also update us on his Ask a Native American project. And our Plainsfolk essay this week from Tom Ezern will be titled Game of Football. We hope you can join us for Main Street on Tuesday. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.